welcome to The Range Brief with Blackman. I'm your host, Jared Rainey. Today, I am joined by the foremost experts in shotguns.
Blackwing.
I've got Joe and I've got Ed. They're cringing right now as I say that. But you guys really are the experts around here. So Joe, the range director, and Ed, by far, if anybody has questions, they usually get referred to you.
Most of the times, yeah.
Yeah. So today we're talking about basically what's relevant if you are in the market for a sporting shotgun, whether that be an over under or hunting, you know, you want to use this thing to shoot clays or to shoot birds. That's kind of what we're covering today. Did I miss anything there?
Or clay birds.
Okay. So define the shotgun. I think that's where we got to start.
Yeah, absolutely. And I hope, you know, this is potentially redundant for people, but it's first and foremost important to realize that a shotgun is designed to not shoot just one single projectile. Although it's capable, it's typically used to shoot multiple tinier projectiles. Originally designed and made popular in the 1500s, King Henry VIII, I believe, really popularized the idea of fowl hunting. One of my favorite things about all this nerdy shotgun stuff that, you know, the old school nomenclatures that we've stuck onto and won't let go. What's really cool and not a lot of people realize is the shotgun was actually designed as like for a weapon of sport as opposed to a weapon of war. Most everything was designed for conquer. Shotguns were designed for, you know, nobility to go hunt birds and provide for the family. So even way back in the day, it was a very noble thing. A peasant like me wouldn't have been able to own a shotgun. We couldn't afford them at the time.
I don't know. You've got a shotgun that costs more than most people's trucks. So we'll come back to that.
The game has changed a little.
All right. So what are the types of shotgun?
I'll hop on that one, Jared. Just to keep as simple as possible, the three main modern types of shotguns right now are break open guns, which basically means you load them in the breech, the back of the barrels, and you close the gun to make it operable. We have a very common pump action shotgun, meaning you load shotgun shells into your gun and you manually operate the loading and unloading of the shells by moving the forend back and forth. And then you have the semi-automatic shotgun, which, again, you load your shotgun shells into the firearm. And once you press the trigger once, the shell goes off, it will kick out the spent hull and load your next full round in the chamber. So it does a lot of the work, the manual operation for you. That's kind of the high-level three different types of actions.
So what would be the advantages of the three, the disadvantages and advantages of the three? Let's start with the pump action. I feel like that's the most common these days.
Absolutely. And I just want to keep in mind that we're going to just completely table the defensive side, the self-protection side of the shotgun. If we get some feedback and people are really interested in that, we'd love to do a whole episode on it. But this is mainly for, as you said, you know, the shooting of clay targets and actual fouling. So to start with the pump action gun, some of the advantages are it's usually the most inexpensive way to get into the shotgun. So, you know, for example, a Remington 870 or a Mossberg 500, you know, you can get into that market pretty low. You know, it's very easy to operate once you get the, you know, the idea of it. You try it out a little bit, you know, very easy to get in the way. I feel like if you're in the gun game long enough, you end up owning a pump shotgun at one point. So advantage, again, you know, easy to get into, you know, it's easy to load, unload. Again, a little bit of the disadvantages is I could argue that it's one of the more higher felt recoil guns. So, you know, it is typically a lighter gun. You feel a lot of the recoil come back to your shoulder, and it's about medium on, you know, pain in the butt to clean. Pretty simple to take apart, pretty simple to keep clean and operating. You know, again, I feel like everyone, if you're in it long enough, will own a pump shotgun.
And capacity is not really an advantage in the sporting world because you're loading two shells at a time, right?
Exactly right. And even on the hunting side, you know, the rules for where you live are, you know, usually no more than three shells in your gun at a time.
So like tube size is not relevant in the semi-auto or the pump action side because you're not doing that in the sport.
Exactly right. And I'll add, if you can get more three shells in an over-under, come see me. I'm real interested in seeing that.
If somebody can do it, it's me. Okay, so what about the advantage with semi-auto then?
Sure. The semi-automatic, if you take one of our beginning shotgun clinics, that's typically what we use. For most people, I will push towards a semi-automatic. Even some of the top-end competitors in all the disciplines are still shooting semi-automatics. So why that is a younger folks or somebody recoil sensitive or even some of the older folks that are shooting, it is hands down the softest recoiling felt or felt recoil gun you can shoot. So, you know, it uses some of that rapid gas expansion and some of the gas that's moving from, you know, the powder burning to operate the actual bolt. The bolt pushes against the spring in the stock, which, you know, takes up energy that doesn't make it to your shoulder. So again, it's a very soft shooting gun. On the price side, it's usually kind of in the middle. So, you know, you can find semi-autos cheaper, as cheap as pump guns, but you probably don't want one. And then if you really like the semi-automatic, you can spend a ton of money on one too. But a nice semi-automatic is kind of in the middle. So another great way to get started. Anymore, they're coming with bells and whistles for a really good price. And then the only major disadvantage to me is they're miserable to clean. They just get dirty. You got to keep cleaning them. I hate cleaning guns.
It's ironic because we probably have the most shot rental fleet like in the state, I would imagine, of just A300s to just take a beating and keep going.
That's a very fair point too.
So with that being said, what about the over under? What's the advantage? And I feel like that's the most common thing I see. That's the most popular option.
Yeah. For your competitive shooter or somebody that really is shotgun is that's their sport, right? They do end up with the over under. I'm a big fan because I like the traditionalism, the old schoolness of it. You know, that's how they started, you know, so the pump action semi-automatics, they don't really do it for me. Typically they're beautiful. I mean, if you're going to get a decent gun, like entry level, you're looking at $1,800, which is crazy for entry level anything, right? Handgun, rifle, all of it. But even the entry level guns usually have beautiful wood or some sort of engraving on them. So, you know, I love the beautifulness of them as well. I shot a pump gun not long ago with a friend, and he says, how many shells does that gun hold? I said, I don't know. I've never put in more than two. You know what I mean? So again, another good fit for, you know, for me on the over-under side. On the felt recoil side, you could argue that they're probably on the highest end of felt recoil. But again, with that extra barrel hanging out in front of you, the gun typically weighs a little more. The heavier gun, typically the less felt recoil. So I put it in the middle where some people would put it on the higher end of recoil. One of the major advantages I'd say on sport or on the sporting end of things is with two barrels hanging out in front of you, you can put two different chokes in the end. So I'm going to get into chokes later and it's my favorite thing to argue about. But at the end of the day, you could set up one barrel for a really close shot to give you the most advantageous shot of knocking down what you're hitting. And then if you shoot like me and miss, you can put a tighter choke in the other barrel as that thing's flying away from you and give you another advantageous shot at knocking down what you're hitting at. So there's some advantages there.
Is there any link to the safari mindset where they want two barrels because it's the fastest possible follow-up shot? Like with a semi-auto, you are delayed by like the time the gun goes off and it cycles. It takes how many milliseconds? Whereas with two barrels and a mechanical trigger or an inertia trigger, which we should probably talk about because I didn't know about this till like a week ago. What is a mechanical trigger, Ed, that resets itself on the second barrel?
Correct.
And an inertia trigger, once the gun fires, it uses that recoil to reset the trigger for the other barrel.
Correct.
I was just curious, does anyone look at that as like, is that a thing?
You know, I've read the same sort of articles, but I've never shot at a, you know, angry bird coming at me that I needed to shoot as quickly as possible. So it doesn't do it for me, but I've read the same articles where like that is the safari mentality.
It's only pertinent if it's a lion or an elephant. Got it. Okay. So we know about the types of shotgun. What are some things that you should consider? And this is kind of a big topic.
Probably the main thing that you'd want to consider when you come in, one, price point. And then second would be just how they feel. You know, you want to get a gun that you're comfortable with, that fits you pretty close. There are some options, adjustable combs, stuff like that, that I think we're going to talk about a little bit later, that we can fit that you can have the gun fit you rather than you try to fit the gun.
So I think, like, going off what you said, the first thing you need to know is, you know, based on that budget, do I want, am I just trying this out or am I like passionate about it? Because I think as a beginner, it's kind of hard to buy in on the over under shotgun, which is like a minimum of, it seems like 2K. But I think the argument between a pump action and a semi-auto is the easiest because you can get a really good semi-auto, like our rental fleet. That's a sub-$1,000 gun. I think it's like $800. And that gun will run ostensibly indefinitely. When you're talking about fitting and what feels comfortable, what would you look for in that category of that, you know, more affordable gun? What are your options?
When I talk about fit, it's how the gun feels in as you mount it. So if you're smaller guy, ladies, kids, you're not going to pick up a 32-inch, you know, 16-pound gun, right? Because it's just going to be heavy to hold. So the semi-autos are a little lighter, a little better, you know, able to hold that up there for a little bit longer without feeling the burns of your pecs and shoulders and triceps.
Sounds like Ed needs to hit the gym.
As the most in shape person in the building. The
most fit guy.
Well, so that's kind of where the fit comes in when you're looking at, you know, shooting, stuff like that. Recoil is a big thing. So semi-autos, some of the higher end over-unders have recoil reduction, just where your hands line up. You know, I've got one that's got a schnobbled front end that I cannot stand. So I don't shoot it anymore. It's in my safe. I brought it out for you to shoot.
That was very nice of you too.
And it's a thumper.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of, that's what you're looking at.
It's a good story. Hey, Ed, I need to borrow a gun for training. Oh, dude, I got you. Don't worry. He brings me the heaviest recoiling gun possible.
Let's give a right-handed gun to a left-handed guy and see what we can do.
And then shoot 100 shells through it in 2 hours. Tell me how you feel.
Got to break you in. Thanks, it's like bud. Being your dad.
Appreciate you. Okay, so I guess we kind of answered that.
What you're alluding to is it's so hard to spend the money, right, without knowing. Go to a reputable place. Have somebody show you a couple options. If you're so lucky, go shoot a couple shells out back. You will know by your cheek and your shoulder if that gun fits you right. This is Goldilocks all over, and I hate it, but you can pick up a gun, it feels great, and you go shoot it, and you have a golf ball-sized bruise on your face. And then you come in with a $400 pump, and you go shoot it, and it just fit you right. You know, your face lined up over the rib where it's not punching you. It wasn't too long from the trigger to the butt so you could see over it. And it's just, it literally is like trying on shoes. And I hate the analogy. It just fits.
So let's break down some of the terms. You just said like three terms. Let's talk about gauge first, because I think that's where we should start. What are the gauges in shotgun that are common?
Common, 410, 28. 20, 12. It's pretty much what we see. There are some other gauges in there. Joe's got a really good story on how the gauges are determined.
Oh, yeah. If anybody out there hears this and wins some sort of prize on trivia, I want 10%. This is the nerd that I've studied shotguns in and went down the rabbit hole. But what's fun is gauge is actually a very ancient way of measuring diameter by using weight. So for example, if you had a smooth round lead ball, perfectly circle, that would fit down the bore, meaning the barrel, it would take 12 smooth round balls to equal 1 pound. All right. To say it a little different, a 20 gauge, the bore, the size of the barrel is actually a little smaller. So it would take 20 smooth round lead balls, the size of the barrel, to equal a pound. So that's just an old antiquated way of measuring before we had modern measuring techniques. And my favorite part about this is like in the early 1800s, the French and the English, for example, they couldn't even agree on what a pound weighed. So if you have like any collectible old stuff, it is like so much fun to figure out why shells do and don't fit your guns. It is a mess, but it is the mess I love.
Oh, shotguns. So 20 gauge. I feel like 20 gauge and 12 gauge are the most common. 410 is still pretty pricey, and it's just not a lot of shot in the air.
Yeah, people say this is great for kids, and I say it's not. It's great for like expert shooters because you want as many pellets as you can get going down range. You can manage a little recoil or a sore shoulder, but if you didn't hit a bird, you're not coming back. So I take all the pellets I can get, and I'll let a kid get a little beat up, but to have him watch himself break clay targets constantly, he's in love immediately.
Yeah, 410 is the most challenging thing to shoot well, but it's the easiest one to shoot. But I think 20 gauge is like, I don't even know if you could give it a percentage in recoil increase. It may be like 20% more recoil.
Less.
No, from 410.
Oh, from 410. Yeah, gotcha.
So it's like a marginal amount of more recoil, but it's significantly more shot.
Yeah, and I could argue like, choosing the right shell is as important to felt recoil as the gun you pick.
I think that people struggle with that because you'll see 7.5 shot and there'll be 5 different boxes of the same shot size.
How much powder is pushing that? That's how much you feel.
But they don't call it powder. They call it dram.
Yeah, dram equivalent. Another one of our fun English nomenclatures that we won't, conform to modern. Dude,
you got to tell us now what that means.
So dram equivalent is an equation of way back in the day when we were using, black powder, meaning it exploded, not burnt. So modern powder is smokeless. Old powder, is plenty of smoke. So it is the same amount of force you can apply using the old black powder equal to the modern smokeless powder that we use. So instead of just saying we've got, 16 grains of powder or whatever, we're like, now we're going to do a giant formula that I don't even know.
Great. Once again, shotgun shooters, man. Or rifle shooters be like, there's this many grains of powder.
The pretentiousness just oozes out of us. I love it.
And then 12 gauge is, so you're saying a 12 gauge could be just as viable for someone who's recoil sensitive if they buy the right load than 20 gauge?
Nailed it.
Okay. And what would they look for if I want the maximum shot pattern, but I want the easiest gun to shoot, what would I buy?
You want the lowest dram equivalent for the lowest recoil is the easiest way to think about it.
Would that be an ounce?
No, that's how much actual pellets are in there. The dram equivalent, you might be like 2.25 or 2.5 or 2.75, depending on the side of the shell. But if you see like 3.25 dram, that's a boomer, buddy. You'll feel it.
Oh, I'm pretty sure that's what Ed hooked me up with in my little day. You're going to need these. Thanks, buddy.
Hey, free ammo.
I bought it.
Oh, well, it was free for me.
Oh, my God. All right. Okay, so that's shot size or shot gauge.
Yeah, we covered way more than we planned on. Well played, sir.
Well, that's me. Next would be some of those terms as far as fitment, like you said, length of pull, which I'm assuming most people know, that's the distance between the trigger and the buttstock. It is at its furthest point would be length of pull. Longer length of pull, typically taller guys.
Yes.
Cast. What is cast?
Cast is, they usually have a, for like left-handed, right-handed, it allows your, they move it over. They'll cast it one way or the other so that your eye is kind of more down the barrel.
Ed just defined the term with the term.
On it. If you take a center line down the stock, it is not actually perfectly straight down from the barrel. They move the stock off to the side so our chubby cheeks can fit. Because the idea is that since there are no sights on a shotgun, you want your rear sight perfectly in line over the barrel, right in the middle, not too high, not too low, not too left, not too right. So they typically push that stock just away from center so we can get our chubby American cheeks in there and have a better chance of it fitting us. And I didn't say cast.
I did.
Nailed it. Okay, barrel length. Now, this one's a mind bender for me as a rifle shooter because it makes honestly no sense to me. Explain to me the difference between a 26-inch barrel and a 32-inch barrel and why there isn't one.
The difference between...
Neither of them want to answer this question.
Yeah, no, it's tricky. I shoot a 32-inch because with the 30 and the 20, 26, 28-inch barrels, I tend to swing those a little too fast, right? So I'm trying to follow along with my target, get out in front of it. With the shorter barrels, I'm out. I can swing it a whole lot faster than I can a 32. So for me, a 32 works out great because I can catch up to the bird, follow along with it, and then be able to pull away from it. So with a 26, you know, I don't shoot a whole lot of skeet. So with skeet, you have a lot more lateral motion. So then you want that fast movement of the gun. Sporting clays, trap, you're not moving too much. Let me just say trap, you're not moving laterally as much. Sporting clays is a little different, but you do have time to, on most of your shots, to follow up, to get on that next bird, and then go from there.
My non-shotgun brain says, why wouldn't you want the shortest gun possible so you can move it as quickly as possible? But you don't see that. I mean, that's most, you know, most guys 5'11" or taller don't run 26 or 28 inch guns. Like you really, we sell 30 and 32 far more frequently. So there must be something to it, but where do you weigh in on this?
You know, at the end of the day, you know, you're right, but everything in the shooting sports is trying to hold something as still as possible. We are trying to shoot something out of a 3D space. It's moving. So we want to be able to have the end of our gun follow our eye very precisely. There is a lot of precision to shotgun shooting, even though you're waving your gun in the air. So to get the perfect balanced shotgun with how strong you are, or lack thereof, you want it to, you know, I always say, like, how does it feel? Because they're like, hey, is this barrel too short or long? How does it feel? And they say, oh, it feels pretty good. We go shoot it, and they still think it feels pretty good. And then he says, well, if I got a 32 instead of a 30, what does that do for me? And my answer is, I don't know. It gets you 2 inches closer to the target before you get started.
Because it has no practical effect on the shot speed or size. Your dram loading and choke are what determine that.
Yeah, you have already, at 26 inches, there's no more powder to burn. I mean, you are at maximum velocity.
So strange.
1500 strange, eh?
It goes a lot, you know, with a lot of people will want to, like Joe said, feel is the main thing. So a younger kid, you know, to come in there, if you're shooting trap, yeah, you want that longer barrel. But shooting sporting clays, you know, a 30, 32 inch, very seldom do you see somebody out there with a short barrel out there shooting. And that's a 26, 28.
I mean, there's more weight associated with those longer barrels. So, you know, maybe a decrease in recoil just because you're adding more weight to the system. I'm trying to think about this analytically.
Just conform.
Oh, God.
Just buy you a 30 inch and go with it.
Okay. So length of pull, we talked about what it is. Do you really get that choice in shotguns? Like, what are your options if your length of pull is too short or too long? And how do you determine that?
There's some measurements we can do. Our gunsmith can measure you and get you the proper length of pull for yourself. There are other things you can do. They've got extra pads in the back that you can take off and make it a little bit longer, maybe give you a half inch, 3/4 inch length of pull. There's also shims you can put in to make it even longer. One of the guns I have has a TSK stock on it that I take a wrench and I just move it out to where I want the length of pull to be.
It looks like a little Terminator leg. It's not even wood. Everything moves on it.
And if you're not a shotgun person, this was really weird for me. So Ed did a patterning board. So he shoots a shell at just basically a big empty sheet of paper to see where the shot is. Was it 25 yards?
Yes.
So at 25 yards, and there's like, you guys want it in a certain place. There's like a rule. What was your expression for over
60, under? 40, 60% of your pellets should hit above your point of aim and 40% should hit below your point of aim. That's our kind of Bible starting spot.
So like the shotgun equivalent of zeroing a shotgun, but they didn't touch the sights because it didn't have any. So he starts playing with the buttstock and that changes the shot pattern, which blew my mind.
Yeah. We moved the comb an eighth of an inch and it moved the shot pattern 4 inches probably.
So you kind of need somebody. It's like, I feel like it would be really difficult to fit a shotgun without somebody who knew what's going on.
Correct.
Like with an AR or something, you can figure it out. You can watch a YouTube video, but you guys look down an empty gun and like match the stock and change things.
This is as close as Ed and I are ever going to be accused of being rocket scientists and NASA engineers.
I mean, it is actually pretty, I encourage anybody who hasn't gone through this process to just have one of these guys kind of show them it. Because for me, it was pretty enlightening that you could make these adjustments and it actually has an effect.
I can remember the first time I made my adjustments on mine, I was totally lost.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay, I need my shot to move to the right. And so I'm trying to figure out, put my eye on the sights and say, okay, which way do I need to move that to get that to go right? And then it just kept snowballing. And finally, I'm just like, I'm so frustrated. I don't know what I'm doing right now. So I had to go back out and repattern it and start all over.
But, and that's with the option. You actually have the tools to make that adjustment on the gun. So you can stay the same, but I've seen Joe take somebody, you know, a gun that has no adjustability. It is what it is. And, you know, he kind of like Jedi's him and is like, put your face here, put your hand there, turn your head and, you know, cluck like a duck. And now they can shoot. It's unbelievable. It's very strange.
Well, the good thing with what Joe does, and he's good at it, is proper mount. A lot of people get off without having a proper mount. They'll go out and shoot and, you know, their heads turned sideways trying to line the sights up. And, you know, you get them straightened up and you get their head moved a little bit forward so they're not clear back on the butt. And it does make a world of difference when you get those lined up. The whole idea with all this is so that your eye is looking where that shot is going to go.
And I think you talk about beads, and you guys have both told me, don't look at the bead. What is the advantage to a mid-bead on a shotgun?
With me, with a mid-bead on there, when I go to shoot, you know, when I mount, I always check to make sure that I'm lined up exactly where I need to be. So that mid bead helps me line that shot up. And then I focus totally on the bird. They call it instinctive shooting.
Tell him why he's wrong.
So there's truth to what he said. A mid bead is halfway down your rib where the front sight is close to your muzzle. So those beads are there to make sure that you lined your shotgun up. If I had it my way, I would, you know, use those beads when you first got your gun, make sure it's fit exactly how I want it. I would make sure that you know how to mount the gun perfectly. And then I'd unscrew the beads because you never need them again. I'd cut them off at every range gun I have if I could get away with it.
And that sounds counterintuitive to anybody who shoots normal firearms. However, these shotgun guys, there's something to it because they took me out and they got me pretty well squared away. I feel like I was holding my own by the end.
Agreed.
Without, when then they had me not looking at the bead at all, which was challenging. But yeah, what about kickoff stocks? What is that? And where do you see that feature?
So with like the Beretta, they have the kickoff pads. They're the kickoff system built into, you refer to like the range guns that we have here, the Beretta A300s. They come with the kickoff pad. What that does is absorb some more of that recoil. So it will actually collapse on the back a little bit and softens that recoil. So your felt recoil, it's got the same amount of recoil, but it reduces it because that absorbs it. So then you have a softer shooting gun.
Now, is it just a rubber pad, or is there a mechanism in there that is doing something?
There's a mechanism in there. So Beretta also has they move that kickoff up into the stock itself. So then that will collapse there. And then the normal one is on the butt of the gun. So when you do shoot off of there, so there's a mechanism in there that will allow that to almost collapses down on itself and then springs back out after your shot's over.
Does that disturb your shot at all? Do you notice that recoil reduction thing?
No.
Wow.
Cause it's after you pull the trigger is when that goes on there. So your sights, I mean, you've got everything lined up. You decide you're going to pull the trigger here. You pull the trigger, and then that's after the trigger is pulled is when that recoil comes into effect.
Do any of the other brands have that, a system similar to that? And what is it called?
Benelli's got one in theirs. I'm not sure Browning has anything.
Yeah, I'm not sure they do either. There's some, you know, aftermarket type of things out there that aren't necessarily for super high-end guns either, but everybody kind of has some proprietary, you know, choices. And I truly, I truly think the shotgun side of things technologically is many years behind what the rest of our industry is, which is saying a lot because our industry is behind by 40, 50 years in most of it. So we're way behind because we don't like to change. We like our old traditions of getting beat all to hell.
Me especially. Yeah. Thanks, Ed.
So the kickoff is a good, if you, and you know, I had a buddy that had a shoulder surgery. So he's like, I'm really worried about shooting a normal shotgun. So we brought him out, fit him up for one that had a kickoff system in it. Never had a problem with the shoulder. So he was totally happy with that.
Okay, so we've learned that a lot of this is this, a lot of picking out a shotgun is what feels, right? Is kind of hard to define. But also, if you can find something that like resonates, there's a good chance that we can make that adjustment or you can make that adjustment to shoot it really well, regardless of feature.
For the most part, yes.
Now, let's get into chokes. I know Joe is very passionate about chokes. Why?
He's getting giddy now.
Yeah, we talked about the advantage of having an over-under and being able to have two different sizes. Why?
All right. The reality is they do change how your pellets fly through the air, right? The best way I can put it for like just an average person is say you're holding a garden hose end and you turn it on full blast. You know, you get this thick stream and it just comes out and doesn't go very far, right? But if you stick your thumb over the end, the stream gets skinnier and goes further. So what I'm getting at is if you have a tighter choke, it keeps your group of pellets flying through the air together over a longer distance. Whereas a very open choke, you know, the pellets start to separate from each other over a shorter distance. The idea being that you have as many pellets hit the target as you can in the biggest circle, you know, possible that, you know, whatever your clay target or bird can't fly through there, right? So you want perfect dispersion in a 2D representation over whatever distance you think you're shooting. Now, here's why I love chokes. In our beginning shotgun clinic, let's just say I have 20 slides. About 6 of them are dedicated to chokes because I'm like, here's any information you need. You got the Bible on it. All I can tell you is at a place like Blackwing or something like that, put an IC, improved cylinder, or a modified choke in there and never take it out again. Because most people that I shoot with, including people that shoot for big money, if they miss, it is not because of their choke. And I can argue till the day is long with you.
So I see that's the most common, right? So even guns that don't have chokes or the ability to change the choke, I see is what they're constricted to.
Yeah, that are modified. I'd say it's 50-50 on like even old guns that don't have a, you know, interchangeable chokes. But modern guns, you can interchange them. So, you know, if you know that you're going on a pheasant hunt in North Dakota, you know you're shooting very far away targets because you're not getting close to them. But if you're going to shoot skeet, you're never more than 27 yards away from a target. You don't need a super tight choke because you want as much air room as possible.
How much, all things being equal, how much more distance would you get out of a full choke shooting 7.5 or 8?
Let's say if you want the perfect pattern that a target can't get through, the difference between a full choke and an IC might actually be about 30 yards.
Okay. So if you're hunting geese, that's huge.
That's fair. But you're also going to be grabbing the biggest and most payload you can. And I would still argue when you're sending an extra 500 pellets down range,
maybe that's making the difference. That's a good point. Okay.
I'm exaggerating for those who are an expert.
Now, we have a pretty broad overview of, you know, the defining terms and some things to look for. Let's get into the cost of shotguns because it ranges from, you know, $400 for a pump action Mossberg 500 or an 870 Remington. And then it goes up quite a bit. I mean,
Joe, that's six figures if you want.
Yeah.
Masterpiece, beautiful.
And there's always levels, but realistically, what is the advantage to spending $1,000, $3,000, $5,000. What are you getting for that money?
So for semi-automatics, I mean, you're going to get a little better components inside, with the Berettas, the A300, the A400, there's about $1,000 difference between those two. It's noticeable. You know, the 300s, they haven't came out with a wood version yet. So it's, you know, you get the polymer, black. They do have different colors now. But with the A400s, pay a little more money, you get that finished look. Both beautiful guns. They both will last you a lifetime. So when you go into the over-unders, when you're looking at, you know, a couple grand kind of starting out for a decent one, you can go less expensive, but I don't know if the quality's there for somebody that's going to shoot competitively.
Yeah, it's kind of like clockwork inside those things. There's some very small parts, and they're very meticulous, especially those mechanical triggers we talked about earlier. There is some stuff going on inside there that looks super complicated.
Yeah, when I first saw the inside of a K80, i.e. like where all the mechanisms are hidden by the stock, I mean, it looked like a freaking Swiss watch compared to like a Casio. I'm not a watch guy. I hope that tracks.
I think you hit a pretty big spectrum there.
I think I took the side off of one of them and looked at it, and I immediately put it back on there because I was afraid I was going to mess something
up. I'm going to lose all these parts.
But yeah, I agree with that. I mean, for example, like if you say I'm going to go shoot 5 shells a year, go hunting with somebody, you can get away with a $300 or $400 gun. But if you expect to shoot 50 shells a month, like it's going to end up in gunsmithing. And that goes for really any type of action. So, you know, with the over-under game, especially, you know, there's some different ways that the guns will operate, meaning like longevity-wise, they won't wear as fast. The quality control was there when they put the guns together at first. But I was joking, and this may not be true, but after about $5,000, you're paying for the name on the side and how pretty it is. And that's just kind of like my general rule of thumb for somebody who has, you know, more money than brains, for example. Like, I, you know, if you're into it, man, I got what you want. I know exactly what you need.
So like rarity of wood, you know, depth and
laser engraved versus hand engraved. I mean, there's just little stuff like that that really goes a long way. And I mean, this stuff gets intricate. And even on the semi-auto stuff, it goes back to components. It goes back to wear. It goes back to who they paid to assemble these things. I mean, it does matter. And it matters. You know, he made a good point between the A300 and 400. It's like, to an average person, they can't see or feel a whole lot of the difference. But if you own that gun for 50 years, you know, that A400 is going to stand up longer, you know, probably a little bit or better steel in the barrel. You know, the guide rods used to work a little bit differently. There's, you know, the right springs in the right places, as opposed to, you know, the A300 came out and it was kind of like, hey, yeah, the A400 was great. We'll take a little of that. We'll take a little of the old design of the 391, mash them together, get some money out of some guys. But they turned out to be great firearms. But the longevity is what you're paying for.
So if we look at back to the over-unders, I'm kind of a Beretta fan, so I know a little bit more about Berettas.
Chill.
We're going to go to a Beretta commercial right now. No, but with the 686 compared to the 694. So when you look at the 694, they really planed those down. You know, it just says 694 on the side. Okay, with a blue line on it. So the engraving, they took away from the engraving, but the thing that they did add in there, they've got the DT-10 barrels that go with these 694s. So you're asking, what's a DT-10 barrel? So it's the kind of the predecessor to the DT-11. They've got longer forcing cones in there. So if you think of a funnel and going from the chamber down to the barrel, okay, on the 686, it's 3 inches. So you're trying to shove all this shot from the chamber down to the barrel in 3 inches. The DT-10s, the 694s, have 11-inch forcing cones. So it's a little more gradual. So you just lengthen that funnel out like threefold. So it's a little more gradual. So it's a little softer shooting gun, which comes into play when you're shooting skeet or trap, not trap, skeet sporting clays, when you have a follow-up shot. You know, you're not getting rocked back, and then you have to kind of get remounted. So that's in there, those DT-10 barrels, the longer forcing cones. It's not the total amount of it, but the inside workings, the locking lugs are different. the four ends different, and they generally have upgraded wood on those.
It's high level. You should see Jared's face. It's like melting right now.
Yeah.
Shotguns. Okay. So what about that's Beretta? What about Browning?
Browning, they have the difference between theirs is they've got the Satori, which is kind of comparable to the 686, and then you can go up to the 725s. This is where it kind of gets a little tricky is because they all have kind of like the CXS, the CXT, you know, the crossover skeet, crossover trap. The CX is just a crossover. So there's little subtle differences in each one of those that, you know, depending on what discipline you're going to shoot is it kind of lines you up a little better for that. So the CXT has a little higher comb so that you can get that 60% above, 40 below, where most of the other ones are going to be 50-50.
So I noticed that some sporting shotguns like trap guns look totally different than like a skeet gun, like a really high rib or only one barrel. Why would you want that?
You know, for example, to answer your question, you know, what you're referring to is like an unsingle. So this over under capable of firing two barrels, they've only got one on the bottom, right? And they've got this big tall rib to fill in the space where the second barrel on top should have been. And again, all it is very specific. You know, we're talking race car stuff here, right? I'm going to put this on because it gives me this tiny little advantage, you know, where it's felt recoil or it's like he said, you know, I want my pellets to land in a very specific spot above the bead that we told Jared not to look at. So bells and whistles, man, it really is. Like you mentioned, you know, I shoot a Krieghoff K80 and, you know, they call for big money, right? But the most frustrating thing on earth is as adjustable as that is and how perfect I dial it in. I shoot a $400 1897 Winchester better than my shoot my gun. And you want to talk about frustrating.
Yeah. So the price difference there is the Winchester's a 10th, maybe a more significant difference between price. So when you talk about big money shotguns, I mean, like Cesar Guarini, Krieghoff, what's another big name?
Kohler.
How much do those guns cost?
10 grand to pick one off the shelf, and then you tell them what else you want.
The most expensive one I ever picked up was $143,000. Correction, I didn't pick it up. I just looked at it.
Good plan.
All right, is there anything that we're missing here that somebody who is new to the sport or like me, completely novice, is there anything we're missing here before you go out and pick a shotgun?
You know, for me, Jared, I think the most undersold thing about shotguns, and I'm not plugging Blackwing here, but the shotgun sports are so agreeable depending on where you are, even on a political spectrum, right? We hold big corporate outings and you know, people come here terrified of firearms. Like, you know, the look on their face when they rolled out of their car, they don't know what to expect. They heard they're going to go shoot sporting clays. They don't even know what that means. And, you know, they're not going into the indoor range where it's super loud and the scary guns from the news are being shot in there. You know, they go outside, they got plenty of room, they're not claustrophobic. And after a few shells, you know, everybody can get behind this. I mean, I've told the story before, but my favorite thing ever was an 80-year-old lady. She never shot a gun, wanted to give it a try. She was shaking trying to load her gun on the first station. And, you know, out of her first four shells, she finally broke one. Three stations later, like less than 20 shells, she's yelling, "I'm going to buy one of these beeps," basically. And like, I mean, you know, it's something that everybody can do regardless of how you really feel about firearms. It's very sporting. It's very recreational by the initial design of them. I mentioned it, you know, it was a gun made for sport, not for war. Like, it's very not intimidating. And, you know, we have kids with wheelchairs, kids that are autistic, somebody half blind. I have people shooting without arms. I mean, like, it's very, very inclusive.
Well said. One last thing, and I'll let you guys go. I'm going to give you a couple of use cases, and I want you to pick out features that you would look for in said use case. So hunting, what are some features that the person should look for if they're goose hunting?
Well, I'm not a big goose hunter by any means, but one thing you want to make sure you do is pick out the right amount of ammunition. Shooting over water, you're not really allowed shooting lead, so you need to do your homework, make sure you get the right shells. Goose loads that are specific to knock down a goose are often very heavy recoil. They're pushing very high mass, very big pellets downrange. So I would want something in the semi-automatic version of that. I would take every advantage I could get. You're also playing on top of water. You know what I mean? So a synthetic type of gun, not wood, you know, you are going to get wet. That's the reality of it. So, you know, something in synthetic, you know, camo, because I don't want that goose to see me from 100 yards out, so they say. And then just make sure you've done your homework and you're bringing the appropriate ammunition and going with somebody that knows how to help you be safe.
Yeah, I think the synthetic is an important point there, because doesn't matter how much you spend on a wood stock. If it gets wet and swells up, it's not going to fit your $50,000 shotgun.
Yeah, and it's going to break.
It's going to crack. The other thing that you can look forward to, that some of the field models have what they call field safety. So whenever you break it open and you load your shells and you secure it, it's going to be on safe.
Like, so it automatically
closes. It automatically goes right back onto safe. So then you have to take it off safe to fire. So that's one of the safety features for hunting. You know, pull it up, you go to shoot, doesn't shoot. Most of the sporting guns, they don't have that, because you're not going to be walking around with shells in your gun. You're going to be unloaded until you get into the stand or on your station, and then you're going to load there. So there's...
you're not walking with a loaded gun ever, not correct. Once.
I guess that is kind of an etiquette thing. The downside to that field safety is every time I've used one, like the first three times I go to pull it up, the damn safety's on,
yeah,
even though I thought I took it off. So I know that can be, you know, use case. Is that like an etiquette thing? Do people require field safeties for...
I don't think it's required by any means, because any of your hunting shotguns are still going to have a safety that you have to manipulate either. But it is nice that if you're going to load a gun, no matter what kind of hunting, and you're going to go walk through brush or through wherever, it took one, oh, I forgot, out of the equation. Where, so like, I'm not a fit for hunter safety, because I hate safeties. They don't even need them, you know, because I load one shell in my gun or two, and I'm as loaded, unloaded as much as possible. So, but man, they're super valuable in the right application for sure.
Okay, so features to look for in a dedicated skeet gun.
Skeet gun, for me, I think I would go with a little shorter barrel. You don't need, I guess you wouldn't. You could get the adjustable comb, the adjustable rib, you don't really need in skeet.
Because you're moving, you're hauling ass.
Yeah. Yeah, those birds come out of there pretty quick. You have a high house and a low house, and they come screaming out of there.
Okay, so short barrel. Anything else?
Maybe an adjustable comb. You know, my weight tends to fluctuate every now and then, depending on how well I'm eating. So my cheeks get a little fatter. So with that adjustable comb, the top of the stock, you can adjust that either left or right, up or down, so that.
I wonder if that's a seasonal adjustment for him. Like every November, he's like, all right, it's about time.
First of the year, I go back.
That's not true. It's how many bags of red ropes he's brought to work for a month.
That's a good point.
They're called red vines.
The most cut up dude at the shop. He also has the worst diet. God, crushing candy and... cookies.
I love this.
I never got candy as a kid.
Doesn't make sense. Okay. I think that's it. If you guys have any questions, feel free, come in, talk to Ed or Joe. Both of them will get you squared away on shotgun stuff. As always, send your questions to sales@blackwingsc.com, and we'll help you out where we can. Thanks for listening.